Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times. I'm Rob Lund. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the March 3rd issue. We're going to start with the category of dance. The article is in Justin Peck's Ella Noise, Dance On and Feel It, written by Melina Reisig. Justin Peck was around 17 when he first heard the Sufjan Stevens album Illinois, an epic paean to the state, nearly two dozen tracks brimming with orchestral indie rock, dense lyrical wistfulness, and sometimes obscure local history. This listening experience came long before Peck wanted to make dances, before he was even a professional dancer, but Illinois urged him to move. "It was an instantaneous, illuminating thing that I felt like it was so danceable," said Peck, now the resident choreographer and artistic advisor at New York City Ballet. "And it is so rare to find someone who can conjure that, especially someone who's alive right now." Ever since Peck, aged 36, has found artistic inspiration in Stevens, "the voice and music that has led me down paths further than I've ever gone before," he said. The two collaborated regularly, including on Year of the Rabbit, the ballet that launched Peck as a choreographer in 2012. Not long after they began working together, Peck, hoping to experiment with storytelling forms, and influenced by dance-pop productions like Twyla Tharp's Movin' Out, asked if he could make a theatrical piece set to Illinois. Stevens took nearly 5 years to agree. Almost 5 years later, the result is Ella Noise, a project that is every bit as ambitious and genre-defying as its soundtrack, a narrative dance musical that combines a coming-of-age story, a snapshot of queer identity, and a meditation on death, love, community, history, politics, and zombies. Growing up, Peck said, the arts, especially theater, gave him a sense of belonging. He framed Ella Noise, or Ella Noise, through a protagonist who seeks out the big city, finding his tribe and his voice and his sexuality, all of these things that a lot of us go through, especially those of us who have moved to a place like New York from smaller or more conservative areas. The choreography weaves together playful punk energy and tap dancing, funky solos and yearning pas de deux, with a cast whose members include ballet dancers and former contestants on So You Think You Can Dance. After sold-out, rapturously received performances at Bard College and at Chicago Shakespeare Theater, Ella Noise runs March 2nd through the 26th at the Park Avenue Armory, with an eye toward expanding to bigger stages, like Broadway. "It feels like the most broadly appealing thing that I have actually ever worked on," said Jackie Sibley's Drury, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, who signed on to help shape the story, which has no dialogue. "But the entire process of it has felt so intimate and personal." This is despite a cast of 16 and an orchestra of 14, with three vocalist musicians who bring their own non-Sufjan tones, including Shara Nova, also known as My Brightest Diamond, who is part of the original recording of Illinois. Illinois was Stevens' breakthrough album, and since its 2005 release, it has entranced fans like Drury, who associates it with a move to Chicago in her early 20s, at a moment when she was determining whether her then-boyfriend could be her husband. He is. "It feels like the album wants you to live your life to it," she said. It's also on repeat in dance studios, not just Peck's, especially during improvisations, said Reki Ubeda, a performer in the show. "It's just so dynamic," he said, "and his voice is so felt, and it's easy to let that move through the body." Ubeda, who won So You Think You Can Dance in 2014, plays Henry, the central character in Ella Noise. He leaves home and meets up with a crew of young friends over a lantern campfire, like a minimalist Wes Anderson scene. They share stories, the dances, from their journals. Henry is reluctant to open up at first, though he happily scribbles in his book as the vocalists sing, "Are you writing from the heart?" That's a lyric from the jubilant track, "Come On, Feel the Ella Noise," Part 1, the World's Columbian Exposition, Part 2, Carl Sandburg Visits Me in a Dream, which plays in an ensemble sequence whose choreography pops with Jerome Robbins-style joy. The show begins with Henry on a blanket, spooning with his partner Douglas, played by Ahmad Simmons. Both performers worked on the 2018 Broadway revival of Carousel, which earned Peck a Tony Award for choreography. He got in touch with them when Illinois was in its earliest stages. "He took us for a walk and talked us through his vision for his piece," Ubeda said. "He didn't really have the answers to what it would become. It was like, how do we tell the story so it was felt and seen without words?" Costumed in a baseball hat, shorts, and a backpack, with a movement style that is both lithe and emotionally bending, Ubeda, age 28, has a Stevens vibe, though Henry wasn't intended to be a Sufjan stand-in, said Peck, for whom the project was not biographical, but personal. "There's a lot of parallels to things I've gone through and people I've lost as a young person in the world," he said. For Ubeda, too. "As a queer person, I've been in Henry's shoes, falling in love with someone who loves you but doesn't love you in that way. A teenage rite of passage," he said. Stevens, age 48, has not been actively involved in the production. He announced last fall that he had Guillain-Barré cell syndrome, an autoimmune disorder that left him unable to walk. He was undergoing treatment and expected to recover, he said in a statement. An intensely private artist, he also shared on social media last spring about the death of his partner, Evans Richardson, a museum administrator, publicly addressing his sexuality for the first time in the process. Though Stevens had been in discussions with the Illinois team about the music, Richardson's death derailed his participation, company members said. Through a representative, Stevens declined an interview request. The composer and musician Timo Andres, also a previous Stevens collaborator, created the arrangements, which include interludes from the album that have not been performed live, Andres said. For the stage version, he tried to keep the DIY spirit of the recording, which was made with many of Stevens' friends, often in ad hoc studios around New York. "It's quite orchestral, but also quite intimate and quite homespun," Andres said. The music also has a grand lushness, he said, as though it wanted to expand beyond its oral container. "It's like hearing the New York Philharmonic in a high school gym or something. It's bursting at the seams." Even in a production of this size, he couldn't match some of the album sounds. "We're not going to hire four oboe players just for this one moment." So he relies on the musicians who perform on stage to convey the complexity with multiple instruments. Nova plays the electric guitar and sings, along with Elijah Lyons and Tasha Vietz Van Leer. The vocalists wear translucent multicolor butterfly wings in homage to the costumes on the Illinois tour. A creative polymath, Stevens stitched those wings himself out of kites, Nova said. In some ways, Nova is the institutional memory of Illinois, but decoupling this performance from her performance making songs like the piercing John Wayne Gacy Jr. with Stevens. "I remember crying at that recording session with him," she said. "Has been intense, especially as she worries about her friend after her traumatic year." What has helped in connection with the dancers, the singers often lock eyes with them, which she called thrilling, and the realization that the music can endure apart from Stevens. "I mean, you can't even look at the audiences because as far as we can see, people are crying," Nova said. "This is why we all come to theater, is just to have a space to feel feelings that we don't see or can't express in the world." For Peck, translating the details of this beloved but complicated album into dance and narrative left him wondering how literal to make certain moments. The creators erred on the side of legibility. During Casimir Pulaski Day, which references cancer of the bone, the dancer Gabby Diaz appears with an IV bag and her partner, Ben Cook, rends his chest. "This show is a little scary for me because it does explore darker themes and darker experiences," said Peck, noting that his choreography often hums with elation instead. "It's kind of annoying, actually, even if I try to not put that in instinctually, it just, like, filters into it." But in one of his last conversations with Stevens about the project, the musician reminded him to peel back the layers of the album, the bright, joyous thing, and lean into its depths. Jessica Desner, an artist, writer, and former dancer, and sister of the Stevens pals Bryce and Aaron Desner of The National, introduced Stevens to Peck, at Peck's request, more than a decade ago. She said that for Stevens, dance turned into a natural extension of his multi-level work, which includes illustration and film. He really just saw it as another emanation of this universe that he creates with all of his projects, she said. Coming into the production as a non-dancer, Drury found herself relating to its emotional beats, like a moment when Henry and Douglas, as a love-struck couple, break through a cacophony and do a simple box-step slide, holding hands and breathing deeply together with their eyes closed. Makes me cry every time I see it, she said. Given his stature in the dance world, Peck naturally attracted high-level collaborators and performers. Execution mattered, but empathy was paramount. The hope, he said, is that the show helps people understand the world or understand themselves, their relationships, or the idea of loss a little bit more, exactly what theater did for me, especially as a lonely young kid. The intention resonated, even in the company members' rehearsal cheer. Feel it, they cried. For our next story, we turn to theater and performances in New York. The article is In the Effect, Investigating Love and Other Drugs, written by Reggie Ugwu. The world of experimental medical research might not seem like it has much to say to the world of theater, but Lucy Preble sees connections. Both require subjects and observers. Both take place within a carefully controlled environment, and both depend on a certain amount of luck. The more I thought about it, the more I thought that's kind of what we do, said Preble, a British playwright and screenwriter. In 2006, Preble became fascinated with one botched medical trial in particular, in which six healthy young Britons experienced multiple organ failure after taking a novel drug. The incident partly inspired The Effect, Preble's play about two participants in a drug trial that alters the course of their lives. First produced in 2012 at the National Theatre in London and performed in New York at the Barrow Street Theatre in 2016, it was revived there last fall and will come to New York on March 3rd for a limited engagement at The Shed. Like the London revival, the New York run will star Papa Esidu from I May Destroy You and Black Mirror and Taylor Russell, who was in Waves and Bones and All, as Tristan and Connie, two people from different class backgrounds with nearly opposite personalities who are given an antidepressant with the potential to induce feelings of love. When the drug proves stronger than expected, testing the boundary between love and mania, the trial's administrators, played by Michelle Austin and Cobna Holdbrook-Smith, struggle to keep it from spinning out of control. They know what they feel, but they don't know why they feel it, Esidu said of Tristan and Connie. Are they experiencing something that's one in 1 billion, or will it be here today and gone tomorrow? Preble wrote the play while dealing with her own heartache and what she described as a bout with depression. I became very interested in what was real and what was not, what was love and what was a false high, she said. I wanted to see if I could replicate that feeling in a theatrical experience. Directed by Jamie Lloyd, known for his bracingly modernist style, such as A Doll's House with Jessica Chastain or Cyrano de Bergerac with James McAvoy, the revival is as slick and gleaming as a pill capsule. Thanks to a jettisoned intermission and other edits that Lloyd made in collaboration with Preble, the show is now a trim 100 minutes, nearly 20% shorter than the original production. There are few props and no costume changes, and lighting design by John Clark augments a bare-bones set with a combination of spotlights and illuminated floor panels, creating the impression of multiple rooms. What's great about Jamie is everything comes from this deep, authentic desire within him to find what is necessary, Russell said. It's never let's be radical in this or that way. It's how can we let our imaginations be the focus here? What gives or takes away from that? Before the London run, Russell had never performed on a stage professionally. She pursued the role after falling for the script and read for Lloyd in New York during his Broadway production of A Doll's House last spring. Coming from a film background, where every day on set is different from the last, Russell worried that she would find the repetition of theater stultifying. But to the contrary, she said, the experience has brought a new sense of freedom to her work. You walk on stage and you have no idea what's going to happen, she said. It doesn't matter whether you feel good or you feel ugly or you didn't do enough prep or you hated your last performance. You have to go on. Essadieu, who in 2016 became the first actor of color to play Hamlet for the Royal Shakespeare Company, said he was attracted to the play's rigorous ambiguity. It is suggested early on that either Tristan or Connie may be receiving a placebo, leaving the audience to guess whose feelings are real and whose are being chemically enhanced. When that mystery is resolved, others emerge. What was this drug really designed for, anyway? And what's going on between the two administrators? I couldn't quite work out whether it was a tragedy or a triumph, Essadieu said of reading the play. Even now, having done it for 2 months, I never quite settle on what I believe. Sometimes I think it's one, sometimes I think it's the other. Preble, who was a writer and executive producer on Succession, a show famous for its volatile brew of tragedy and comedy, said she tends to lean toward tragedy in her own writing. There is an argument that tragedy is the more optimistic art form, she said. Comedy essentially doesn't allow for change because it has to constantly reset itself. But in tragedy, chance is possible. In the end, everything is different from where it began. The characters in the play have undergone some evolution since it was first performed more than a decade ago. Connie and Tristan, originally from Britain and Ireland, are now from Canada and East London, where Russell and Essadieu each were raised. And a pivotal dance that Tristan uses to charm Connie has been changed from Irish tap to a hip-hop shimmy, modeled by Essadieu, working with movement directors Sarah Golding and Yukiko Masi, after the stage shows of Childish Gambino and Tyler, the Creator. For the New York run, Preble said she will make a few additional changes to contextualize some culturally specific references, for example, but preserve fundamental character and plot details. Is there a difference between American audiences and British ones? In Britain, they laugh a line earlier, Preble said. It's almost preemptive, like they want to do the joke in their own head or let you know they see what's about to happen. And, as with any play or science experiment, the real breakthroughs are the ones you don't expect. It has to be allowed to change and be specific to the moment, Essadieu said. If you're chasing that high that you had before, it's never going to work. As I continue to read from the March 3rd edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section, we're going to turn to the subject of music. The article is written by Steve Smith, reporting from Hanover, New Hampshire, and it's entitled Composer Uninterrupted, Christian Wolfe at 90. If artistic stature worked by osmosis, Christian Wolfe could claim greatness based on that alone. My father met Brahms, he said, easing into conversation at a sturdy wooden table in the dining room of his Hanover, New Hampshire home. That meeting was in 1896 when Brahms was in Bonn, Germany, for Clara Schumann's funeral. Wolfe's father was 6 or 7. Wolfe's grandfather, a violinist, conductor, and professor, knew Brahms personally and professionally, he said. His great-grandfather, also a conductor, was a supporter of Robert Schumann. And my great-great-grandfather was a champion of Beethoven, so there is something back there, he added, laughing at the implications of such a heritage. Wolfe, who turns 90 on Friday, is associated with a different pantheon. He is the last living representative of what's known as the New York School of Composition, a group that included John Cage, Morton Feldman, Earl Brown, and David Tudor. Their tight-knit circle shifted mid-century American music away from classic European models, and it radiated out, intersecting with other arts and artists who were making New York a leading center of modernism. The choreographer Merce Cunningham, the poet John Ashbery, the painters Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, and many, many others. Wolfe only lived in New York City for just under 20 years. Even so, he retains historical and aesthetic ties to it. Accordingly, he'll be in town for a series of events celebrating his birthday at Judson Memorial Church in Greenwich Village. On the Saturday, a multi-generational group of friends and acolytes will present works spanning his career, including a new piece Wolfe composed for the occasion. The location is auspicious. Judson Memorial Church, a hotbed of experimental art and dance in the 1950s and 60s, is just blocks away from the site of the Washington Square tenement where Wolfe's family settled after fleeing wartime Europe. It was there that his parents, Kurt and Helen Wolfe, established Pantheon Books, which published Carl Jung, Joseph Campbell, Paul Valéry, as well as the first English translation of the I Ching. At the time, Wolfe was more attuned to the classical repertoire favored by fellow émigrés like the violinist Adolf Busch and the pianist Rudolf Serkin, both family friends. "I wasn't quite, well, obnoxious about new music," he said. But that changed thanks to his piano teacher, Gret Sultan, a prominent soloist whose repertoire embraced contemporary music. Determining that he wasn't suited to a career as a pianist, Wolfe began to create his own works. When he asked Sultan to recommend a teacher, she sent him to Cage, who lived further downtown on Monroe Street. "When I introduced myself by name," he said, "it's a good name for a composer." "And then he offered me a cigarette," Wolfe said. "I was 16, I don't smoke." He says, "How can you be a composer and not smoke?" Although he was Cage's junior by more than 20 years, Wolfe exerted an influence on his teacher, not least by presenting him with the I Ching translation, a book that would prove decisive in Cage's search for a method to guide chance operations. In a letter of recommendation to Dartmouth in 1969, Cage wrote of Wolfe, "He is not known as a student of mine for the reason that I learned more from him than he from me." Feldman also acknowledged his younger colleagues' innovations. "Christian Wolfe's early music, his development, the suggestions in all his work have continually haunted my thinking," Feldman wrote in 1964. After an early period involving intense reduction of musical materials like the proto-minimalist Duo for Violins from 1950, Wolfe sought to create structures that cultivated chance and also required performers to pay close attention to one another, listening for oral cues to proceed. Or, conversely, to play similar material independently, in tandem. Increasingly, his goal was to allow players of differing abilities to work together. Over the years, Wolfe explored a variety of strategies. Graphic scores, text pieces, geometric configurations in which clusters of standard notation hung suspended in expanses of white space. The results could be agitated, evanescent, or surprisingly direct and tuneful. During the 1970s, sparked by the Vietnam War, he wrote overtly political works based on folk music and labor anthems, striking a middle ground between poles established by two friends, Frederick Rzewski's virtuosic, The People United Will Never Be Defeated, and Cornelius Cardew's populist agitprop songs. Regarding that phase, Wolfe offered two observations. "One, it's for the converted," he said. "That's not even an issue. It's a solidarity thing. The other side of it is pedagogical." He cited Wobbly Music, a 1976 choral work whose title nods to the Industrial Workers of the World, a labor union founded in Chicago in 1905 and nicknamed the Wobblies. "Most people had never heard of who the Wobblies were, and that's one of the most important political movements in United States history," he said. "So that's just a matter of reviving people's awareness, of making them aware that there is a history of left-wing resistance to the status quo, and that's part of the American tradition." You could argue that all of Wolfe's music, in requiring performers to make considered, mutually respective decisions, is political. Robin Shulkowski, a percussionist who has worked extensively with Wolfe, suggests as much in Wolfe on Composition, a 2022 documentary directed by Ernesto Livon Grossman. "What's the music doing now, and does it need me?" Shulkowski asks. "Does it need me to be quiet, or does it need me to participate? It's that open invitation all the time, so it's hugely political, I would say, listening today." Beyond his work as a composer, and informing it, too, Wolfe remained active as a performer, playing in a wide variety of settings over the decades, from a longtime association with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company to a surprising album with Sonic Youth. Unlike Cage, he embraced improvisation, performing as an adjunct member of the English ensemble AMM. Even now, he continues to embrace spontaneous collaborations, and will do so during his birthday concert. Designated a mini-marathon, the concert is being organized by String Noise, the violin duo of Conrad Harris and Pauline Kim Harris. They are producing it with Issue Project Room, the Brooklyn Experimental Arts venue, in partnership with the Judson Memorial. The Harrises have assembled a program spanning the composer's entire repertoire, from the early duo for violins to the newly composed What If? Wolfe will improvise with the composers David Behrman and John King, colleagues from Merce Cunningham's company, and with Ikkyu Mori, the MacArthur Grant-winning electronic composer. His influence, though difficult to define precisely, has continued to grow. "There's something in the best way unfinished about Christian's work," the composer and improviser Michael Pizarro-Liu said in a video interview. Mr. Pizarro-Liu, age 62, has had a long, close association with Wolfe's music as a member of the Vondelweiser Group, a composer's collective profoundly inspired by the New York School, and has played and recorded with Wolfe. "Much as I love Feldman's music, if you imitate it, it's always going to be second-rate Feldman because it's a highly idiosyncratic and personal language," Pizarro-Liu said. "Obviously, Cage was immensely influential, but if you're a composer and you share a lot of Christian's interest in the agency of the performer, in the social aspect of that, there's a goldmine of techniques and ideas in the music that you could take up without imitating Christian." What makes Wolfe's ingenious achievements even more remarkable is that for most of his life, composition was a sideline to his principal career as a professor, a course he pursued in order to reliably support his growing family. He studied classics and literature at the University of Florence and Harvard University, and then taught classics at Harvard from 1962 to 1970. Arriving at Dartmouth in 1971, he began to teach music for the first time, alongside classics and comparative literature. A visit to the house in Hanover revealed little to suggest that a composer who works daily at his ars is in residence, though Wolfe does keep percussion instruments and other assorted noisemakers in the basement. That there is no piano is merely a practical matter. Since Wolfe retired from Dartmouth in 1999, he and his wife, Holly, spend most of their time about 40 minutes away on a farm in Vermont. The piano is there, along with horses, sheep, and gardens. Anyway, he isn't fussy about working conditions.
"We had four kids," he said. "I've learned to work under almost any conditions whatsoever. My favorite place is just on the kitchen table up at the farm, with people coming in and out."
It's important to have a piano nearby, he added, but having it in the room where he's composing is a distraction. Some argue that instead of hindering his composing, his divided focus and growing family caused a fundamental evolution in his approach. Interruptibility, Michael Hicks and Christian Asplund wrote in a 2012 biography, had to be taken into account. Collecting ideas and assembling them like a mosaic became habitual, they write, and the lessons learned from children, especially rhetorical strategies, insinuated themselves into new works. Asked whether his present work constitutes a late style, Wolfe chuckles.
"It's late because I'm old and I've been doing this for a ridiculously long time, with lots of interruptions and trying to juggle other stuff."
He's obviously aware of the profound visionary works composers like Beethoven and Verdi wrote in their later years.
"Occasionally I think, am I just repeating myself?" he said. "It seems to me one's head is just wired in a certain way and there's a limit to what you can produce."
Still, he's been too busy to worry about it since becoming a full-time musician for the first time in his life after retiring from teaching. Another new work, Piece for Seven Percussionists, will have its premiere in a concert by Talyajan at Roulette on April 15th. Wolfe is working on a piano quintet for Ursula Oppens, a longtime friend and champion, and there's plenty of demand beyond that.
"Yeah, it's been 20 years now," he said, "but I've suddenly started really writing a lot of music."
Movies will be our next subject. The article is Denis Villeneuve and Timothée Chalamet, Dune Dynasty, written by Amy Nicholson, reporting from Los Angeles. The director Denis Villeneuve and the actor Timothée Chalamet bound into the room talking at and over each other in rapid French. Villeneuve is from Quebec. Chalamet was born in New York City, but has dual American and French citizenship. Together, they're a dynamic tag team dressed near identically in head-to-toe black, although Chalamet's shiny leather layers have more swagger. The topic of the day is galactic genocide and dubious messiahs, central themes in Dune, Part 2, the second installment of their cerebral space epic based on the 1965 novel by Frank Herbert. Yet the pair are prone to giggle fits.
"We didn't see each other since a while, so it's like a holiday," Villeneuve, age 56, said apologetically, switching to English.
When coffee arrives at the room at the Four Seasons Hotel in Los Angeles, the two clink mugs.
"That's our spice," he chuckled, referring to the psychedelic substance found only on the movie's planet Arrakis.
In Dune, spice is the most valuable resource in the universe. Herbert conceived of it as a glittering dust with the power to expand minds, fuel interstellar travel, and incite bloody battles over its distribution. Combine the brain-melting effects of peyote, the geopolitical strife over oil, and the violence of Prohibition-era bootlegging. Multiply that by the number of stars in the sky, and, well, you get the idea. The previous Dune, released in 2021, won 6 Academy Awards. It climaxed with Chalamet's sheltered scion, Paul Atreides, abducted from his family's spice mining compound and left to die in the scorching Arrakis desert, patrolled by fanged sandworms the size of the Empire State Building. To survive Part 2, Paul's mother Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson, encourages the Freemen, a tribe of desert dwellers, to believe that her son is their long-awaited savior. The danger is that Paul might be swayed to believe it too, even as the hallucinogenic spice peppers him with visions of a jihad waged in his name. Heavy stuff. Not that it's weighing down their mood. As Chalamet, age 28, grinned, he said, "The great irony of working with a master like Denis is, it's not some pompous experience." The two spoke further about the next potential sequel, the impossible quest for on-screen perfection, and those infamous Dune popcorn buckets. Here are edited excerpts from our conversation. The Times says, "People have described your dynamic as father and son. Is that how it feels to you?" First, Denis Villeneuve.
"At the beginning, I had a lot of empathy for Timothy that he was stepping forward in a production of that scale. He is the age of my kids, and I was trying to find ways to take care of my new friend. Maybe I was paternalistic."
Timothée Chalamet adds, "I was grateful. The scale was so large. The actors were such titans. I felt a protected aura."
Villeneuve interjects, "When he walked into the set of Part 2, it was totally different. Much more confident, much more solid. He was not impressed by the size of things anymore. You were jaded."
Chalamet, "No."
Villeneuve, "It's the first time that I had the chance to see an artist growing up in front of the camera. It's very moving."
The Times says, "You came into the room speaking French. Did you use it on set as your own language?"
Villeneuve agrees, "Yes, it was the way that we were able to find intimacy in the chaos. It was our protected landscape, a second secret language."
Chalamet adds, "He said it perfectly, our bubble." Audiences could have left Dune Part 1 thinking, "This Paul Atreides kid is terrific. I can't wait to see him take over the planet," The Times says. Here is where disillusionment sets in. Villeneuve explains,
"Frank Herbert wanted the book to be a cautionary tale, a warning against charismatic religious leaders. He felt that he failed because people misperceived his intentions. So he wrote Dune Messiah, an epilogue where he made sure his ideas would be seen. I think the movie's more tragic and more dramatic than the book because it's closer to Frank's intentions."
The Times, "You've talked about making Dune Messiah based on Herbert's second Dune novel, which picks up 12 years into Paul's reign as Emperor of the Known Universe. Under his rule, 61 billion people have died." Villeneuve curses at Chalamet. Chalamet responds, "I didn't write it." the Times. But you're waiting until Timothy is older. 6 years from now, will you hide his sunscreen so he'll age faster?
Villeneuve, he will look forever young. We'll have to use the magic of AI.
The Times. Yet Paul's visions of the future are not what will happen, they're what might happen.
Villeneuve concludes, yeah, I tried to make sure that you could in some ways explain scientifically what is happening. Paul is a young man that is oversensitive to a hallucinogenic, not psychotic. Chalamet adds, psychotropic. Villeneuve, psychotropic sense, a substance that gives insight into the future. I didn't want the character to go, okay, it's going to happen in 5 minutes, I'll take my coffee now. Like weird dreams, they're mystical, they are enigmas. The most important thing when we dream is not the images, but the emotions.
Frank Herbert's spice was psilocybin, the Times says. He was into mushrooms way before microdosing mushrooms became mainstream.
Villeneuve comments, from being in California.
Chalamet adds, in the 60s.
A product of his time, Villeneuve concludes.
But people, the Times says, also call him a person ahead of his time who predicted elements of our future. What would he say about the present?
Villeneuve clarifies, he would say I was telling you.
Chalamet adds, I warned you.
Villeneuve, it's frightening how precise he was.
The Times. I have a good friend with a tattoo of the Dune quote, fear is the mind killer. Has making these films affected how you handle being afraid?
Chalamet interjects,
I'm playing a grounded character who is simply by way of the eyes on him, going through something I can relate to.
Villeneuve notes, movies are very long to make, so it does have an impact on your own psyche. Definitely, it put a seed inside me. I developed an aptitude to be comfortable not knowing the answer right away.
The Times then says, it's been a rough year for superhero movies. This story asks us to think harder about heroes, chosen ones, saviors. Timothy, is it fair to assume that if you wanted to play a superhero, you've had opportunities?
Chalamet expresses, well, Leonardo DiCaprio said to me, no superhero movies, no hard drugs, which I thought was very good.
Villeneuve, which one?
Chalamet says, I follow them both, but the movie that made me want to act is a superhero movie, The Dark Knight. If the script was great, if the director was great, I'd have to consider it.
The Times asks, Dune exists in a post-computer world. Computers were destroyed and everybody decided not to rebuild them.
Villeneuve observes, they banned AI in the computer. They are trying to increase the human capacities biologically instead of having external machines. Dune is not much of a science fiction movie. It's more about embracing a new culture. For me, it's more interesting to explore sandwalking. It's more poetic and cinematic than a spaceship.
The Times says, in that spirit, you filmed in physical locations in Jordan and Abu Dhabi that stood in for a planet where it's only safe to be outside at sunrise and sunset. That must mean pulling off scenes in a narrow window of sunlight. Go, go, go. Chalamet answers, definitely. Those scenes with Shani, Paul's love interest, played by Zendaya. We would shoot at dawn, sometimes over 3 days, because you have 30 minutes or an hour.
Villeneuve expresses, it gives a lot of credit to the actors because the cinematographer, Greg Fraser, who won an Oscar for the first Dune, and the director are stubborn and want a precise light that will exist for 10 minutes. I didn't want to make any compromise. There's scenes that on screen look very simple, but would be shot in several different environments just to make sure that we have the right rock at the right color at the right time of the day with the precise sun. It was constructed like a puzzle.
Yet, the Times asks, I had the impression that you welcome a bit of imperfection to balance the grandeur. Here, Florence Pugh wears a chain headdress that's sliding off her nose. Another director might have jumped in between takes saying, we've got to fix that, make it straight, make it perfect. You chose not to.
Villeneuve looks pained, so Chalamet observes,
he's going to go edit it right now.
Villeneuve responds, no, no, it's a balance between perfection and life. Life is chaos. I'm pretty OCD, but the performance will always prevail. I know exactly what you're talking about. Good eye. Leonard Cohen says that when there's a crack in something, that's where the light comes in. I believe in that. Part of me tried to do it perfect, but life is stronger and I prefer that. Imperfections make this world feel human, says the Times. Villeneuve reflects, I'm moved by what you're saying because it's something that challenges me. Sometimes I know that the camera movement is not absolutely perfect, but there's something in the performance that breaks my heart. Expletive. I will choose that take because it feels more powerful. The Times then says, neither of you are strangers to intense compliments. Denis, you've been called a genius, this generation's Stanley Kubrick, to which Villeneuve says, I learned very early in my career that the bigger the flowers, the bigger the pot that follows after. If you receive a big compliment, someone else will say that you're a hack. Chalamet says, that is a great quote. The bigger the flowers, the bigger the pot. Wow. The Times then says, and Timothy, you were nominated for your first Oscar at 22. You both must have insight into the arc of this film, the temptation to buy into your own hype. Villeneuve expounds, fortunately, I've always feeling like an imposter, so there's no danger. Chalamet explains, I'd say the difference is in this story, there's human life at stake. The role of an actor is never that consequential, even if you're making powerful work and people relate to it. That makes sense? Villeneuve just says, I was not listening. The Times, I hope you're not thinking about Florence's nose. And Villeneuve shakes his head. No. Chalamet, he's texting Joe Walker, who also won an Oscar for editing Dune. Villeneuve retorts, there's a specific moment when you know that the movie's finished because you try to correct the editing and the movie bites you back. Chalamet, don't touch it anymore. Villeneuve, it's not perfect. Chalamet adds, I had a thought, actually, about this scene, and they both laugh. The Times, Timothy, you once said that when Denis held a copy of the book Dune in his hands, his body language was like a little kid. How so? Chalamet responds, just incredibly enthusiastic and playful. He would take time to think on things or go to the book. Even Austin Butler in interviews said he thought he found the voice of Fade Rautha, Paul's sadistic nemesis. And then Denis said, let me dream on it. Villeneuve shakes his head, bull, he's not here, we can say that. Chalamet, but Denis' total enthusiasm inspires everyone on the set. Every actor, every crew member, you want to make him proud. Villeneuve interjects, cinema is an act of presence, an act of being totally open. I know on set I look like a four-year-old. I'm aware of it. But having fun with the toys is the way I make cinema. The Times says, speaking of, the internet seems intimidated by the souvenir sandworm popcorn buckets. Chalamet shoots a quick glance at Villeneuve. Both chuckle nervously, and Villeneuve comments, I don't want to make stupid jokes right now that will I regret tomorrow morning, but I will say this. When I saw it, I went, holy smokes, what the blank. At the same time, it created a lot of fun online, so maybe it's positive. It's some kind of impressive design. The Times says, I respect a bold choice. And Chalamet comments, I can't tell if someone is at home right now going, my design worked perfectly and everyone's talking about it, or if someone's brutally offended by the response, to which Villeneuve says, at the end of the day, it seems that bucket brought a lot of laughter and joy, which I think is, Chalamet finishes, something we need more of. Villeneuve, but I was not. Chalamet says, you were not personally involved in the design process. Villeneuve looks at him, I thought you were. Chalamet says, my idea. And both laugh. Turning to the subject of art and design, I will keep reading from the March 3rd edition of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section with the article, An Architect Builds Toward a Future on Mexico's Border, written by Sam Lubell, who is an architecture writer based in Los Angeles, reported from Agua Prieta and Naco in the Mexican state of Sonora. In July 2020, the Mexico City-based architect Fernanda Canales faced a difficult decision. Tapped to participate in a new federal initiative providing hundreds of civic facilities, like libraries, parks, and streetscapes, to under-resourced towns across Mexico,
she could either work on relatively familiar sites along her city's periphery or take on a handful of structures 1,200 miles north in Agua Prieta and Naco, two small, poor towns with a high crime rate along the U.S. border. Agua Prieta's ignominious claim to fame is being the site of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman's first border tunnel for smuggling drugs and weapons into the United States. Naco has more unpaved roads than paved ones. Given their populations, about 92,000 for Agua Prieta and 6,000 for Naco, both towns have witnessed their outsized share of cartel-related violence, femicide, and disillusionment. At first, Canales said no way to the border, opting for the safer destination about 2 hours from home. But something kept gnawing at her to take on the tougher challenge. Canales, age 49, had taught design solutions focused on the border at Yale and Princeton and written on the topic extensively. "I can't keep doing this theoretically," she remembered thinking. She told her family she was opting for the harder choice. 3.5 years later, her team's buildings are complete. Many are handsome, remarkable achievements that have met local needs and strengthened fraying social ties. They are also case studies in the profound challenges and just out-of-reach opportunities of trying to rehabilitate communities via building. Programa de Mejoramiento Urbano, or PMU, the urban improvement program created in 2018 by Mexico's powerful Secretariat of Agrarian, Territorial, and Urban Development, or SIDATU, is one of the largest public construction programs in Mexican history. While major government initiatives had in the past focused on providing housing, schools, and other basic needs to marginalized towns, civic spaces accessible to everyone had long suffered from a lack of resources, said Roman Mayer Falcón, the secretary of SIDATU. "These are neighborhoods that for decades have not had a field, a sports facility, a public market, a plaza, a road," he said. Mayer Falcón, who is just 40, studied architecture, a rarity for a cabinet member. Known for keeping a tireless schedule, Mayer Falcón said PMU has so far completed about $2 billion worth of public buildings and community infrastructure. Towns applied for help through a rigorous process. Once their projects are completed, they are responsible for maintaining them. Selected architects and designers, many highly regarded smaller offices, have already completed about 1,035 projects, often in remote areas, with some winning international architecture awards. They don't just design one structure in a town, but 3, 4, 5, or 6. In return for this exceptionally rare opportunity, designers have had to move absurdly fast with relatively little control. Each works under a builder. Canales kicked off her projects with a site visit in August 2020. She and her team had to complete initial design by the end of October. The first buildings opened in fall 2022. "It was crazy," said Canales, who designed 5 projects in Naco, a pavilion for the town's plaza, a market, a daycare-slash-cultural center, a senior center, and a gymnasium, and 2 in Agua Prieta, a sports complex and library. Achieving this kind of outlay would have been impossible for her tiny firm, which usually hovers between 2 and 4 people. So she quickly put together a large team of fellow architects and consultants. Many had never met, let alone worked together. Alberto Garcia, her former student and longtime collaborator, took on a supervisory role. He had never been to the state of Sonora. Now, he's been 15 or 20 times. "I've lost count," he says. "The first time I came, I was very concerned," said Garcia, who has 2 young daughters and a wife, a fellow architect who helps run their Mexico City firm, Viga Arquitectio. The challenges came quickly, balancing competing local visions, managing town-wide skepticism, restrictions from the U.S. Border Patrol, COVID-related delays, cost spikes, and work shortages. One day, he said, a new builder started working on the project without warning. Payments were unpredictable, but with the help of a local SIDATU manager, Alan Zamora, the team members worked tirelessly, embedding themselves into each community, getting to know its needs, players, and politics. On a recent tour, Garcia drove me through each town like a local, whizzing past rambling neighborhoods, rickety storefronts, and empty lots along uneven roads. The new buildings, which are by all accounts the largest public investments in either city's history, don't look like municipal buildings with sheetrock walls, glassy facades, and blasting AC. They are timeless, tactile, and elemental, dominated by red-orange brick, sandy-colored concrete, and pre-rusted steel, arranged into broad arches, lacy lattices, angled roofs, and snaking ramps. Some don't have windows, lighting, or air conditioning. The robust designs, said Canales, grow out of a mountain of demands, including a desire to reflect local context and history, a need to build quickly, cheaply, and sturdily with Sonoran materials and labor, and to respond to limited budgets and a harsh climate, not to mention crime and vandalism. It's about having things that are not easy to break or steal or be torn apart, said Canales, who has learned the hard way in other public projects how to make each building adaptable and pivot if municipalities can't or won't pay for basics like water, electricity, or maintenance. I tried to think of the worst-case scenario as the real program, she added. They're also flexible. A basketball court can be used for volleyball, boxing, or concerts. Concrete benches double as play structures. Stairs become seating. Another key strategy, making places that pull people in. Plazas and courtyards contain feathery mesquite and blue-green palo verde trees and employ brickwork that blends with the buildings themselves. Partial walls are inviting and limit the need to pay or fix heating and air conditioning while keeping people inside safer from crime thanks to increased visibility. Lattices, inspired by traditional Mexican screens called celosías, provide privacy while permitting breezes and light. Just as important as the practicalities, the buildings are designed to build social connections. They are created as places to stay and be proud of in locales that are often regarded as pass-throughs, overshadowed by the ever more tumultuous border and what's on the other side. Without opportunities for social interaction, places are more insecure, divided, and isolated, said Canales. Yes, you need many more things, hospitals, housing, education, the list goes on and on. But if you can't even step out of your house and feel safe, then the other things won't work either. She ticked off her many goals. How can you provide value to a landscape that is neglected? How do you provide an opportunity to see your town in a new way? Added Zamora, no matter how small a town is, its people deserve a certain quality of space. Perhaps no project addresses these fundamental issues quite as dramatically as Agua Prieta's library, a woven, bar-shaped building, its arched edges sitting parallel to the striated, mural-saturated steel border wall, about 10 feet away and just west of the town's international border crossing. The construction team had to limit use of large ladders during construction to prevent people from climbing over, said Garcia. Its ground floor is a sunken outdoor recreation area, with rounded concrete stairs doubling as amphitheater-style seating, and a stage covered with a mural painted by students, emblazoned with brightly colored plants and mythical creatures. This area hosts celebrations and performances while also serving as a cool, shaded place for local parents to wait for their kids, who often attend school on the other side of the border. You reach the library's glass-enclosed floating second floor by a winding concrete ramp that provides wheelchair access and a rare vantage point from which to take in both Agua Prieta and Douglas, Arizona. Canales said she took a risk by placing the building and adjacent lengthy park so close to the border. But she wanted to create a dialogue with infrastructure that had for so long stood as an intimidating symbol of separation and fear. We can touch it, she said of the wall. It's part of a place we're going to be playing, biking, and reading. The community is literally being pulled together here. Families gather below to chat and play. The Bachiqui Festival of the Arts, with its concerts and markets, arrives every May. Residents have donated books and furniture for the space upstairs. A book club meets on the second floor every Saturday. It has separate meetings for children, teenagers, and adults. The youngest readers recently put on a play downstairs inspired by the characters from the book Un Ogre en Busca de Cuente, An Ogre in Search of a Tale. Three girls showed up as Little Red Riding Hood, a challenge that was deftly navigated. Inez Acosta, who helped found the club with her son Gabrielle, said that there had been no public library or even a bookstore in the town before. "We've taken over," she joked. "They let us stay after closing." Garcia Canales' associate explained, "It's helping form a sense of identity." He added, "Usually you see the other side of the border and they have better things, cars, schools, shopping. For people to have spaces like this keeps activities in Mexico. It makes people proud to be from here." Agua Prieta's sports park, open on all sides, a contrast to most recreation facilities in town, which are enclosed by concrete or stone walls, greets locals with a plaza fronting a sunken gym. Its jagged steel roof draws glowing light and creates angled shadows. Children play basketball in the gym, which spills out to turf sports fields, busy with soccer matches. Residents sit on the concrete bleachers watching teams play. "It's the center of our social life, a place for people and families to come and have a good time together," said Marcia Gerardo, a teacher, who noted that while older kids play soccer, their younger siblings can play at the complex's playground and skate park to keep their minds busy, she said. This is a common refrain here, a reminder that kids are regularly pulled into drug trafficking or other criminal activity. In Naco, some projects are having a similarly beneficial impact. But Canales' worst-case scenarios also have come true, at least for the time being. Naco's new gym, topped with a peaked metal mesh roof that has a monumental profile on one side and a more intimate scale on the other, is at the crossroads of three neighborhoods and a local train line. It's a popular place after school hours, where lights allow play into the evening. But its basketball hoops have already lost their glass backboards, which were shattered by vandals. The community replaced them with plywood and is clearing out weeds and removing trash. A new marketplace, intended as a gateway to the city, combines a textured brick plaza with barrel vaulted structures rising asymmetrically to form a three-story tower, meant as a viewing spot. But it has been severely vandalized and is now surrounded by chain-link fence. The cultural center, a short drive away, contains an art gallery and auditorium intended for parties, performances, and graduations. The gallery is displaying local photographers' evocative images of native Sonoran people and landscapes. But right now, the auditorium feels more like a quiet ruin. It is dark and imposing, and it has no electricity except when long cables are run from the nearby school. "These places look lonely," said Domingo Zazueta, a NACO parent and coach. "They don't invite activity." Andrea Ramos, the town's former mayor, who worked to have the projects built, blames a lack of support from the town's current mayor, Lorenzo Villegas. Mayor Villegas, contacted by text, did not respond, but Roberto Villa, NACO's Minister of Culture, said that electricity would be supplied to the cultural center, though he did not know when, and the daycare center would soon open for use. "It hurts," says Ramos. "This is the most important series of projects NACO has ever had." Zazueta said the community leaders aren't spreading the word about the facilities or showing people how to use unfamiliar structures. Denise Vasquez, principal at the adjacent school, pointed out that she and her colleagues still have to finish submitting paperwork to use these spaces. Jorge Casillas, superintendent at the NACO Senior Center, said that some residents had complained that the projects were too big for a tiny town to take care of. Some spaces here are being kept afloat by local sweat, like the gym, or by the state, which feeds 75 seniors a day at the new center. Others are not. Canales takes such challenges in stride, playing the long game. "They will survive local circumstances, issues of budgets, politics, and vandalism," she said of the new buildings. "The long-lasting possibilities remain.
Over time, the public starts to make decisions and inject life. Things change and adapt. Time teaches us what prevails. Often, it's what we can't imagine now.
The story does continue, but we will stop there so that we can include other stories for this week. That is it for this week's reading of the Arts and Leisure section of the Sunday New York Times, the March 3rd issue. I'm Rob Lund. Have a great day, and thank you for listening to Chris.